Good morning and welcome to this August 23rd, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. Both of these interviews this morning were pre-recorded last week, so just know that. I am your host for the hour, Marie Stone. Today we're diving into the short story, and you all know how much I love that. I'm excited this morning to welcome Megan Kenny, and in the second half, Michael Knight will be here with his latest collection, Eveningland. Megan Kenny was raised in Connecticut and New Hampshire. She received her BA in English and Creative Writing from Kenyon College and her MFA in Fiction from Boise State University. She was the 2008-2009 Tichner Fellow at the Gilman School, a Bernard O'Keefe Scholar at Breadloaf, a Peter Taylor Fellow at the Kenyon Review Writers Workshop, a Tennessee Williams Scholar at Sewanee, an emerging writer at Franklin and Marshall's Emerging Writers Festival, and has held residencies at the Vermont Studio Center and Lemuse in France. She has lived in France, Japan, and Peru, and has taught writing and literature extensively. She currently teaches at Lancaster County Day School in Pennsylvania and will be teaching a contemporary American writers course at Johns Hopkins University MA in the writing program this fall. Her stories have appeared in literary journals, including the Gettysburg Review, Cincinnati Review, Hobart, and the Kenyon Review. She was awarded the 2005 Iowa Review Award for her story, The Driest Season, which was a Pushcart Prize special mention, and her story, Heartbreak Hotel, won second place in Glimmer Train's 2012 Fiction Open. Her short story collection, Love is No Small Thing, is out with LSU Press. Her debut novel, The Driest Season, is forthcoming from Norton in February of next year. We are talking about Love is No Small Thing this morning. Megan, welcome.
Thanks.
So I wanted to read that full introduction to give writers, especially writers of the short fiction form, some idea of all the places, all the resources, and the workshops and residencies that are available out there, because there's such a kind of wide and rich variety of these things. And I think a lot of writers feel very isolated, or they feel like, how the heck do I do this? So this is how you do it, right?
I think so. I think there's a lot of ways to do it. I teach writing to adults online as well through Gotham Writers Workshop, and a lot of those people are also working full-time as lawyers, bankers, not in the education or writing world. But I do think they feel isolated, and I always recommend trying to get to at least a conference where you're going to meet people face-to-face and be able to have that one-on-one time with other writers so you don't feel so lonely and weird.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you what you felt has been kind of the most helpful throughout your writing career to you as a writer. Kind of, you know, if you recommend some of these summer writing programs, if some stand out in your mind better than others, I know you don't want to choose your babies, but if there are things that you've found that are particularly helpful over the years.
I mean, for me, the biggest was probably choosing to study writing in undergraduate and then going to get an MFA. And I was young enough and lucky enough that I could do that full time in my mid-20s. But I think even for people who aren't able to go full time, I think it's an extraordinary resource to be able to devote, if you can, to devote that time to writing and reading and thinking about writing and talking to other writers about writing and having that support. Because I think you rarely do get a group of 5 or 15 other writers who are happy and willing to read your work and give you honest, good feedback. And so that was the most valuable resource to me. It was to have 3 straight years in an MFA program. Beyond that, I would say Sewanee and Breadloaf Writers Conferences and the Kenyon Review Writers Conference in the summertime were also wonderful resources as a way to meet other well-known established writers and to get to work with new writers who have different styles than your original professors may have had, and also to make connections. I'm a late bloomer in this writing world. I mean, I started writing 20 years ago, and my books are just coming out now. And I think I've lived in such random, strange places, and I think having connections and knowing the right people does for better or worse, make a big difference as well.
For sure, yeah. I also think, you know, writing is one of those things, unlike sports and athleticism, that you just get better over time. The bigger the body of your experience and the more, you know, life stuff you've seen is just, it's one of those things that ages well with you, thank God.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
Hopefully, right.
Hopefully.
Yeah, right. So take us into this collection. Love Is No Small Thing is your first collection of short stories. You've published widely in separate short stories in journals, and some of those are in here. But a collection is its own thing. You know, disparate stories do not always a collection make. And so kind of globally talk about what you were thinking about with this book and how these stories came together.
Like I said, I mean, this book, these stories, some of these stories were started 10 or 15 years ago, and then I just kept building. This collection in a different form was done 10 years ago, and I started sending out for agents, and all the agents wanted to see a novel. So I had sent, I just set the collection aside and spent 6 years writing a novel. And then when I came back, sent both books out looking for an agent. And by that point, I had written a few new stories that seemed to fit better in this mix, and with a theme of love. And so we'd kind of taken some out, put some new ones in, and tried to balance them, too, in terms of, you know, I'd say about half the stories are written from a male point of view and the others from a female point of view. So tried to sort of balance those gender points of view as well, but really make it feel like that theme of love was really running through the whole collection was important to me, but that was not on my mind when I started writing these stories. It occurred to me much later that that was a theme that I kept writing about and keep writing about. And so once I figured that out, it was easier to envision what a collection might look like. But sadly, I'm not a good at planning ahead my writing projects. I really kind of just move forward one day at a time instinctually. So I think that's what happened then when I finally was ready to put this book together. And that's how it came together.
Isn't it interesting that time and distance and putting something in the drawer for a while and then you come back to it and you're like, oh, this is really what it's about. This is really where my area of interest was all the time. And I kind of didn't see it when I was mired in it. But now, you know, maybe it's becoming clearer to me, or, you know, maybe that's really what I was writing
about. And I don't think I even knew clearly. I had a couple of good friends in graduate school. And I think one night after a workshop, we were kind of pointing out what each other's obsessions were in our stories. And I mean, they told me, you know, you keep coming back to these relationships and families and love. And so, yeah, it wasn't even my own realization. I think it was someone else telling me, which is really interesting too, because I think a lot of readers can find things in your work that you never even knew were there.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Mm-hmm. Do you, you know, I love the short story form for so many reasons, as my listeners will well know, because I talk about it all the time. But I do feel like it gives you a chance to try new things and to give yourself, set challenges for yourself, and to work in different forms. And I wonder if you do that, if you are a little bit more exploratory than maybe you were in your novel, or if you set yourself, you know, I'm going to try like the male point of view, or I'm going to try second person or something like that, that lends kind of a different texture than you would get over the course of a whole novel.
I think for sure. And I think with some of these stories too, I think I've aged and evolved over the span of this collection alone. And so I think some of them were trying on new things and new personas and gender and all of that as a writer and the second person. I think that was my Laurie Moore phase of writing and reading. But I definitely more exploratory with stories in the novel now, for now at least. The novel is very sort of straightforward. I mean, because I didn't really know what I was doing, so I just tried my best to keep it simple with the novel. But I think with stories too, even now I find myself experimenting more and taking more risks. Maybe even more with a little bit magic realism or with form, you know, maybe not as traditional, as I as I'd learned to write in graduate school. You know, I was sort of raised on like the Raymond Carver, Tobias Wolff, and Beattie and Alice Munro, sort of very traditional short story, realistic short story writers. So I have started exploring more, and it's been really fun. And I feel like you can do that because you're not investing 300 pages or 6 years of your life right. in that experiment.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah.
I've always wondered if the MFA, you know, I think there is some risk of it. I don't have an MFA, but I have heard there is some risk of MFA writers sounding alike because they come up in the tradition of that and in the tradition of reading kind of the same writers. And now that you say that, it sort of triggered that memory of, I wonder if in some ways it becomes sort of a constraining thing.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I mean, I think on some levels I can see how that would be true. I think one thing it does allow you to do is to try things on in a safe environment and fail and then try again. Mm-hmm. And so even if you're trying on, you know, Raymond Carver and then you're trying on, whatever other writer you're reading and enjoying at that time in class, I think that's not completely discouraged. And I don't think that's a horrible thing entirely. You know, I think even people who aren't possibly in an MFA are still probably learning through what they're reading, you know, and figuring out how that other writer they really like is writing that stuff on the page and crafting their story. So that might be more of a human instinct to me, but yeah, I mean, I can definitely see and understand the critics of the MFA, but I don't think I would have been able to make a lot of forward movement. I mean, I would have gone out and just gotten a full-time job and probably maybe
right.
tried to write on the side, which I'm trying to do now as a more of an adult. But yeah, I don't know that I would have really committed to staying with it for
yes.
all this time had I not had that experience.
Yes, right, right. So mm-hmm. let's pull a couple of these stories out. There were so many that I loved in here. And I maybe you're a better chooser of these than I, but one of the things that I've been doing with short story writers of the last 6 months or so, and it sounds like the same question that I keep asking writers, but it comes up with so many different answers, is to take one of these stories and kind of deconstruct it. And I usually ask writers to choose a story that maybe confounded them or gave them the most difficulty or they worked on the longest, or a story that started as one thing and ended as something totally different that they didn't see coming. But I thought maybe you could choose one or two of these and we could do that with this and talk about kind of the original kernel of the idea, what the inspiration was, and then, you know, through the revision process, through what the characters did that you may not have expected, kind of where the story ended up.
I mean, I think the one that confounded me the most, that I didn't work on consistently the longest, but I certainly started a long time ago, put it away, and kept coming back to it a little bit over maybe 10 years, was Man is the Measure of All Things. Mm. I had written the opening paragraph or two to that story. I mean, I don't even, it was a long time ago, maybe 2001. And that's 16 years ago. And I was living in Sun Valley, Idaho that summer. And so I think I used that as a setting. But then I literally I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know where it would go. I didn't know who this guy was. And I just put it away and maybe came back to it 5 years later. And I always really was drawn to the opening. And then I just kind of slowly kept chipping away and moving forward. But, I mean, when I say slowly, I mean maybe a page, maybe half a page at a time. And I didn't know what that ending would be. I did not expect those guys to have two boys on the wagon in the back. I knew that they were menacing, and I liked that the two men on their ATVs or four-wheelers were menacing, but I just didn't know what the story was about. I didn't know why he was there, why he was going there, I think, until much later in terms of revisions even. And I think the time, I was in graduate school, so I was, you know, a broke graduate student, and Sun Valley is a pretty affluent community. And there's a lot of locals who live there too. And so I think there was always a lot of tension there between the locals and then the sort of wealthy people who come in to their big cabins and vacation homes. And so I think that aspect of class really, found its way into that story, with Russell being a carpenter of sorts, and then these wealthy people whose homes he works on.
That's really what came out to me, was the issue of class in that story. And it's funny, I was born in Sun Valley. And so I immediately connected to that. I saw the Ketchum in that. I was like, who the heck has ever heard of Ketchum besides me?
I have.
But yeah, you have. But yeah, I mean, it really, the menacing undertone with this, you know, obviously it's a guy walking into a party where he otherwise wouldn't have been probably invited, and a little bit exploited, and a little bit, you know, kind of used for both, used for a lot of things, really. And then, you know, he's kind of the wake up call. I mean, I think... this story in this time, I always think it's interesting to talk about what world a book is born into. And obviously the story was written a long time ago, but maybe some of these issues are more relevant today than they were even when the story was written, or they're on our minds more even when the story was written. So that's...
Well, and it's funny because I started it maybe 16 years ago, but this was the last story I finished for this collection.
Oh, interesting.
So I didn't even finish this until, I mean, when it was published in the Kenyon Review and... just a couple of years ago. So I just finished it a few years ago. So that story had a long meandering life before it came into full shape.
What do you think it is sustains you? Like, when do you know? Because I feel like if I'd had a story that stuck around for 16 years, I would have just thrown it out, right?
Right. You know, that's a really good question. And it's funny because my style and voice, I feel, does change a little bit over time and has changed a little bit. But there's stuff, I have a file on my computer that's just unfinished stories, but their story starts around 10 pages into something and I like it, but I just don't know what to do with it. And I keep those, because there's, I just think it's like dating, right? It's just rare to really meet somebody you like a lot. And those are those little story starts. These are like the possible boyfriends from my past that I really like them. I don't know how they fit into my life yet. So I keep them around and then maybe they'll be useful at some point.
I love that. And that's so good.
I don't know where that came from, but
it's really good.
I mean, it's like an image or a feeling or a voice. And I think it's, as writers, you know, it's hard to find those little sparks that, I hate just getting rid of stuff just because I don't know what to do with it right away. And I'm a teacher full time. And so even, you know, teaching the writing process to middle school and high school kids, I just don't think, I know my teachers used to, but expect kids to know exactly what they should say and how to say it in the first draft. So I think, you know, when I find that moment or that thing that I want, I think it will lead to something else, you know. And sometimes those old things I had sitting around for years that I pick out and weave into a different or a novel or, so I think they can come in useful or handy, even if they themselves don't become the story. They can become part of another story too.
And I think the really interesting thing is when the writer has no idea. I mean, you said over and over about this story.
No,
I didn't understand. Yeah. I didn't know why he was there. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know why these guys had they show up on their ATVs. Mm-hmm. So that idea that the writer has no idea, so the writer's trying to figure it out, makes it, obviously, it makes it impossible for the reader to guess what's going to happen, because, you know, if you got it all figured out, I think you tip your hat to the reader that, you know what's going to happen, so the reader's going to know what's going to happen. But if everybody's exploring together, I think that makes for really interesting fiction. Dangerous.
I remember my professors used to say, exactly what you were just saying. If you know what's going to happen, if it's exciting or you already know what's going to happen, your readers will likely see that too. Now, that said, I really admire my writing friends who can plan and plot a little bit more and write outlines and be much more efficient and effective in getting a book written. I think that is a real skill. I just don't possess that skill, at least not yet.
Let's talk about All These Lovely Boys and where that story came from, because it was another one that was just so unexpected to me and so unique and so beautiful. And talk a little bit about the genesis of that.
It's one of my favorites, I think. So this was from a prompt, and several of these stories were from writing prompts that I did not give them to myself. They were either given to me by a writing friend, or this one in particular. I was at the Kenyon Review Writer's Workshop one summer, and Nancy Zafiris, who is the workshop leader, gave us this wonderful prompt that I now use myself with my own students, where it was to take different elements and push them together and make a story out of it. And so those elements were, she gave us a note card with a first line on it, so we had to use that first line. And then we had to pick a tragic event. Mine was jumping out of airplanes to one's death, although in the end I didn't make him die. And then, but that's where the jumping out of airplanes came from. And then she had given us each two pictures out of a magazine. And you had to use those people as your characters and figure out how they know each other and how they fit into the story. And so one of my characters was a man who was cross-dressed as a ballerina, wearing a wig and sparkly cat-eye mask and everything. And the other was of like a camera crew. So a cameraman, a lighting man, and a cop. I left the cop out of it. And so those became the characters. I started off from, I think, a different point of view. So I kind of played around for a bit before I found who was the point of view character. But it was unexpected for me too, and I think sometimes, or at least for me, when I can step out of myself as a woman of a certain age or a race, it's freeing to explore something else entirely. Now that said, you know, it's still about a father and a son. And so that's where I found my common ground, was the parent-child relationship. And so that's really what was driving the story for me, was that parent-child relationship and acceptance of you know, each other, and that love between a parent and a child. So that's where I found that common ground for these characters. So that's what I knew. And then these two strangers walked into that.
So many great things came out of what you just said. One, for new writers or old writers, this idea of putting disparate ideas together for writing prompts is wonderful. I mean, it always yields so many interesting, weird things, because you juxtapose, you know, monkey with airplane with, you know, whatever the prompts are, and you're going to come up with some new crazy idea. And then you yourself as the writer is going to get interjected into that with your own stuff. And, you know, the underlying theme of love you can't get away from, probably. And so, you know, that's going to get in there too. Just because that's what's on your mind, you know. So great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the thing that's really, that I try to teach my own students when I use that sort of, that kind of prompt, is that that there is, you know, it isn't just writing about what you know. It's not just writing about your own experiences necessarily, that there are elements to a story, and that you need to sort of try to put these elements in some sort of fashion that tells a good story. And so it is sort of teaching something about craft or storytelling too, in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I can't believe we're running out of time, but I really want to get on to titles because your titles
Sure.
are so good. And
Oh my gosh, thanks. I really struggle with titles, so that's really nice of you.
well, it's funny you should say that because after I would finish each story, like I'd kind of try and hold the title in my head and then I'd fail and then I'd finish the story and I'd go back and look at the title and then I'd be like, that's so good. I mean, I would have
Oh,
never come up with that title in a million years. And
wow.
you know, the challenge for short story writers is you have to come up with 10 of them instead of just one for a novel. So, talk a little bit about that. Well, I don't know if you can, because you said that you struggle with them, but
I
no,
really
I didn't.
struggle with titles. And my peers used to always make fun of me because they thought I always came up with the cheesiest, most sentimental titles. So that's really nice of you to say. I think for me, what I would end up doing would be going through the story itself and either looking for phrases or words that somehow captured the overall part of the story. So, like, Love is No Small Thing, for example, you know, shows up on, what is it, the third page of the story, where she says, you know, I wanted to thread my life with another's and make something for ourselves. Love is no small thing. So that was part of her own narrative. So sometimes it's for me trying to find that sort of powerful or distilled line that might represent something bigger from that story. And then a couple others were a little different. Man is the Measure of All Things. I don't know how I came. I stumbled upon. I don't know how this had a different title altogether before, but this is an old saying from an ancient Greek philosopher named Protagoras, and it kind of just encapsulated the idea. So the idea behind this phrase is that there is no absolute truth, but that individuals sort of deem, you know, what the truth is to them from their perspective. And that seemed to fit since, you know, there was one side of these people, you know, one group of people who saw the world in one way, and then another group of people who saw the world in another way in that story. But really, for the other stories, I'm usually not that sophisticated with my titles. The other ones really were just little lines lifted from the stories themselves. We're
And when I
trying to
found them, I
hear
was
is
like, hey, I.
in the story. Heartbreak Hotel is in the story. Winter, Wisconsin is just a descriptor of what their story is taking place in winter in Wisconsin. So I feel kind of, yeah, a little basic, but I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sometimes they feel like Easter eggs to the reader. You know, you're like, oh, I found it, which actually feels
Right,
pretty satisfying,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. Right.
Oh, God, we're out of time. Any last
Oh.
minute advice, writers that you love that you would recommend that people might not have otherwise heard of? Anything you want to leave us with as writers, especially writers of the short story form?
Oh gosh. I think that for me the one thing I've learned and that writing really has been for me a game of endurance and patience and persistence and perseverance. You know, I think people shy away really easily with rejection, and I don't think that this is your profession if you're not okay with that, but I think you just keep going and you don't expect fame and fortune, but you write to write and you know, you just keep going. And finally, hopefully your books find a home somewhere. But even if they don't, I think you just keep writing, right? If that's what makes you happy.
Yeah, the
So.
people that I know that love this, I mean, they do it because they love it, or they're trying to figure out their own life, or they're trying to figure make sense of the
Right.
world, or there's some other
Right.
reason they're doing it, not for publication. And
Right.
if you're doing it
Right.
for that, you're right, you're in trouble.
It's certainly a nice validation, but
Indeed.
it doesn't pay the bills.
Yeah, right. Oh,
Yeah.
Megan Kenney,
So.
this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh. Thank you.
We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Michael Knight will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. There are direct downloads to hundreds and hundreds of shows. We are celebrating our 20th year anniversary next year, so you can't imagine the number of interviews up there, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Michael Knight is the author of the novels The Typist and The Divining Rod, the short story collections Good Night, Nobody, and Dogfight and Other Stories, and the book of novellas The Holiday Season. His most recent novel, The Typist, was selected as the best book of the year by the Huffington Post and the Kansas City Star, among other places, and appeared on Oprah's summer reading list in 2011. His short stories have appeared in magazines and journals like The New Yorker, Oxford American, Paris Review, and The Southern Review, and have been anthologized in Best American Mystery Stories, 2004, and New Stories from the South, The Year's Best, 1999, 2003, 2004, and 2009. Michael teaches creative writing at the University of Tennessee and lives in Knoxville with his family. His collection of linked stories, Evening Land, is out and available now. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Michael, welcome.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Oh, I love, love, love the short story form, as I mentioned. So this is a huge, huge treat. Huge, huge treat. I love it when I Google search on your name and it comes with a lot of Knight Rider hits. So I don't know if you love that, but I loved that.
Well, I loved it more when I was 10 years old. Now I'm not sure it does much for one's literary credibility to be associated with David Hasselhoff and that haircut. But, I guess it could be worse.
It could definitely be worse. So I am going to give you a chance to take us into Evening Land, this collection of linked short stories set in the very rich setting of Alabama. I want you to talk about a lot about that. But kind of take us into the book and kind of talk about what's been on your mind, maybe kind of the course over which these stories were written and, some of the themes that have been, you've been knocking around when you put the collection together.
Okay. So like you said, Evening Land is a collection of linked stories set around Mobile Bay in South Alabama, where I grew up. And I wanted, each story to be strong enough to stand alone. But because there are recurring characters and recurring themes, and because the place itself is so central to the heart of the book, I guess, my hope is that, as you read through the stories, they'll begin to acquire a kind of cumulative force, that kind of novelistic forward lean, and that by the time the reader gets to the end, we will have arrived at a place that is greater than the sum of the sort of individual component parts. You talked about Alabama. In some ways, I guess I thought of this book as a kind of love letter to my hometown. You know this too. Everybody knows this, right? That like all the great loves of our lives, that feeling, that sensation is always more complicated than the word itself implies. I mean, there are family stories here. There are stories about natural disasters. There are stories about home invasions. There are stories about infidelity. And, what I'm trying to do, I guess, is sort of look into the heart of this particular tribe of people who live around Mobile Bay, where I grew up.
Yeah. Yeah, I always think it's interesting to talk about the time and place a book is born into. And I don't know over the course of which these stories were written, but it feels, just within the last 5 days or whatever, the South is taking on new meaning again. I think issues of class and race and all of those things are alive and well as they always have been, but they're resurging again. And I do just think it's interesting to set a book in its context. And I wonder if you feel like this book is even more alive, even more relevant than maybe even when you were writing the stories.
Well, yeah, it's funny that you mentioned this recent event. I went to UVA, so my wife and I both did, and we've been glued to the television all weekend. I don't know how Evening Land fits into all this. You know, someone asked me when I was out on book tour, what was the sort of point in writing a book of short stories, which is essentially about upper middle class and upper class white people? Like, why should we bother caring about their problems? And for about 10 seconds, I was sort of pissed. You know, I mean, I sort of thought, what do you mean? You know, love is love and loss is loss and family is family. No matter what your race is or your class is or your gender is or your ethnicity is or any of that stuff, all that stuff should be universal and it should be human. And I still feel that way, though frankly, that question did lead to a very interesting conversation in the course of this this interview. And I think the stuff that's been happening in the last few days, you know, it reminds us of the things that we all ought to find universal about our humanity, mm-hmm. you know, and it reminds us of the things that we all ought to reject. And, you know, I mean, I do think the people that I'm writing about in Evening Land live in a sort of cloistered world, right? They're protected by their money. Certainly they have genuine, deeply human conflicts, genuine and deeply human needs and desires that the stories try as hard as they can to address. But they are sort of sheltered from a lot of what's been happening recently in the news, and they are exactly the sort of people, I think, the people in the stories, I mean, are exactly the sorts of people who now at this moment in reality, like, need to be opening their eyes, you yeah. know, and sort of looking around and saying, this isn't the sort of thing we can hide out from anymore.
Yeah. Right.
Did that make sense? Did that make sense? It didn't sound all that coherent as it was coming out of my mouth.
No, nope, it was you're absolutely spot on. I think that's exactly right. And there was one story in here, Jubilee, I think it was called, and I just loved the opening of it. And I kind of wanted to talk about beginnings and endings of short stories because I think they're tricky to get right. But this particular story, just the beginning of it really struck me, and I'm now flipping through the book trying to find it. But it was something to the effect of these two towns looking across the bay at each other, like kind of like old lovers, and what right. they saw in each other. You know, it kind of had a Great Gatsby sort of feel to me. But it I don't know, they're just so beautiful. It was called, I'll just read the first sentence here. These two satisfied towns gaze at each other like old flames across Mobile Bay, handsome, a hide-bound Mobile with its lawyers and its cemeteries, and blithe Fairhope, pretty Fairhope, with all its galleries and boutiques. It's just so, I don't know if you can talk a little bit about the point of entry of that story, if that's kind of where it began, or, you know, kind of the imagery that you were evoking. Again, kind of beginnings are really challenging, I think, for a lot of writers, and I just thought that was a perfect one.
Well, you're awfully kind, my gosh. So there are a couple ways I think to talk about that beginning. One is like from the writer's point of view, like how to make this work as a short story or how to make it fit into the book as a larger whole. And then the other one is, you know, sort of maybe connecting it back to the things that we've already been talking about. But, so I should say about Evening Land. So I published two collections of short stories before Evening Land, and, Evening Land is my first collection, which was written with the sort of larger whole book in mind, you know, sort of imagining how one story might fit into another story, how it might all add up to something else, as opposed to, you know, here are 10 fine, recently published new stories by Michael Knight, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And so at that point in the collection, when I was working on Jubilee, I had Landfall, the novella at the end, and I had the first story, and I had a couple stories in the middle, and I was kind of looking for a way to move through geography and time, you know, from the Mobile side of the bay into the other side of the bay. And I was also trying to move from youth, you know, the first couple of stories are about younger characters, sort of coming of age stories. And we're kind of moving in the course of the collection from youth to age, you know, from innocence to loss or something like that. That's just kind of the way I see the kind of motion in the whole book. Mm. And so that that beginning was a way to sort of do that, to go from a character in the previous story who is in a kind of spiritual crisis and is on the verge of having to make a decision that's going to change the rest of her life. And then moving into two characters who've already made that decision being to go ahead and settle down and accept this life that they've been born into, and deal with all the consequences that that brings. And so I hope that beginning would provide a kind of transition into that, you know, from sort of youthful inexperience into a sort of more mature, murky and complicated in some ways, middle-aged experience. And, you know, I'm rambling a little bit at this point, so you can cut me off at any moment.
No, that's
any problem,
beautiful.
But
yeah.
the word that I like in that sentence, given the context of what we've been talking about, is the word satisfied. You know, and that's to me, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love the place where I grew up. It was a beautiful place to grow up, and my childhood could not have been any more idyllic. But there is a sense everything's okay. We're satisfied with the way things are about those people in that place. That has always been a little bit troubling to me, you know, as a human being and as a writer. And I thought worth exploring, you know, as a writer. So that to me, just hearing you reread it was the word that stood out to me in the sort of larger context of the things we've been talking about.
Yeah. Right. I do think it's so interesting how many writers return to their place of childhood to set either novels or short stories, and how, you know, I don't know if it's because you're in a place before you have language for it and, you know, kind of in a pre-verbal taking the world in that seeps into your subconscious, or if it's something else. But I do see a lot of writers who just keep going back to their hometown, whether it was idyllic or whether it was horrific or whatever it was. I do think that provides a lot of fodder for writers. So I was interested in hearing your take on that. And it's complicated. You're right. Love is complicated.
Oh, it's impossibly complicated. I mean, you know, I think the place that we grow up, especially if we have a fairly rooted childhood, right? If we're in one place for a long stretch, and that place where we grow up, it becomes the kind of lens through which we see everything. You know, we're constantly, even subconsciously, we're constantly comparing everything that we run into for the whole rest of our lives to the way we learned to see the world when we were kids. And so we're always going through this process of sort of accepting the things that we knew and loved when we were kids, or rejecting those things and reshaping our lives according to that thing. So we're always in a relationship to that place, you know, the place that sort of birthed us, you know, that sort of defined us at our most nascent moment. And, you know, I think that's sort of true of family as well, where, like, those are the only people in your life that you don't get to choose, that you have an intimate and complicated relationship that you don't get to choose. You know what I mean? They're going to wreck you and nurture you in equal measure, and you're sort of stuck with that. And you come out the other side who you are based on those relationships. And, you know, I mean, family, we mentioned this already, but I think family features large in Eveningland in particular.
I really appreciated all your comments about how the book was structured and the stories came together, because you're right. I think, you know, a story is one thing, but a collection is really its own thing, and it has to hold together as its own arc. And ordering these stories from innocence to loss, and from, you know, young age to old, and, you know, moving across the bay, I think I did want to come back to that theme that you had mentioned earlier, that you can't just slap 10 stories together and expect it to make a book. I mean, you really have to be intentional about that. And obviously this was so intentionally put together. So congratulations on that. It's beautiful.
Oh, well, you're very kind.
Yeah. I do see some short stories that I'm like, how did this one get in there? And they're like, I don't know, you know, I needed 10. So
it's funny. I mean, people have lots of thoughts about that. It, you know, maybe I talked about this already, but my first two books, what I basically did was just keep writing short stories until I had, you know, 12 or 15, enough to make a book, and then sort through those stories, looking for linking themes and looking for ways to order them that might make for an interesting big picture sort of read. But this one was different. I mean, I wrote the novella at the end, Landfall, first.
Huh.
But it was, you know, I wrote, that story's almost 10 years old, but it was sort of too long to publish in a journal and too short to publish by itself. And so it just sat in a drawer for a pretty long time until I wrote the story Water and Oil, which is the first story in the collection about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And it occurred to me somewhere in there that the characters in these two stories might know each other, and that they existed in the same social world. and that maybe there was a book here. Maybe there was a way to write some more stories or tinker with some stories that I already had that that added up, you know, as I said, to this sort of something that was better than, stronger than, more powerful than just a whole bunch of decent stories by a writer named Michael Knight.
So great. Speaking of which, my guest today is Michael Knight. The book is Evening Land, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So if we could, I've been doing this experiment with a lot of short story writers over the last 6 months, and the question is always the same, but the answers are always so fun and different that I keep asking it, which is to take a story out of the collection and deconstruct it. And maybe it's this, maybe it's the novella at the end, or a story that sort of confounded you, a story that you worked on maybe the most. But take us from sort of original point of entry, original kernel of the idea, through, you know, how maybe the character surprised you, how it ended up someplace you didn't think it was going to end up, and your revision process, your thinking process, and I don't know, just kind of deconstruct one of these stories for us.
Well, you know, really I could do that with almost any of them. I mean, they all had long and sort of complicated revision processes, but maybe we could talk about Jubilee again, if that's all right. That,
sure.
That to me was one of the hardest stories to write, and it took the longest. And, you know, so and it started off with what was probably not a very good idea for a short story, but I wanted to write a story about a happy marriage. You know, I have a happy marriage. I know lots of people who have happy marriages. And it seems to me that it ought to be, because it is part of actual human experience, it ought to be a suitable and rich subject for art, right? Happy marriage. So I sat down to write a story about a happy marriage and discovered that, like, you can't really have a story that has no conflicts, right? I kind of knew that in advance, but it came as a big surprise to me, you know? I had these two characters who had been married for a while, and they were sort of middle-aged, and the husband was about to turn 50, and they were happy, and they lived this beautiful life. And then I began to try to write a kind of conflict into it, but everything that I considered was sort of pat and obvious. For instance, you know, at one point I had the wife contemplating infidelity, and maybe she was going to cheat her husband, and I had the husband obsessing about this couple that lives next door, and, you know, were they happier than they were, and what was it about them, and none of that stuff worked, and I just kept piling up pages, and one day I just sort of started taking every single plot element out of the story that I had written in, just taking everything out that had anything to do, anything that was all recognizable as conventional plot, and what I found that I was left with the couple was this feeling of longing. But that was grounded in, it wasn't grounded in anything false, like these sort of forced plots that I was trying to put in. It was just this sort of sense of longing underneath these happy scenes that I really liked, and that actually turned out to be, I think, the thing that I meant to capture, you know, from the very beginning. And from that point, you know, it wasn't that hard. I mean, it was hard to make the images clean and precise and get the language as graceful as I could, but it wasn't that hard to sort of know the heart of the story, you know, to keep going forward with that at the heart of the story, if that makes sense. Is
yes.
that kind of thing you wanted me to do, or is that or
That's
was
perfect.
Something else you had?
No, that is absolutely perfect. And then talk about the titles, because I feel like titles are also difficult. Maybe we can take that story or any of these stories. You know, short story writers have to do this so many times over the course of a short story collection. And titles have to do double work, you know, or even triple work. I mean, they have to inform the story on a couple of different levels. And I think that's hard to do. So talk a little bit about how you go about that.
Well, to be honest, I'm terrible at titles. And usually I try to land on a title that sort of gets out of the way and lets the reader get into the story as quickly as possible. Though in that particular case, so there are a couple of sort of literal things that I should say. One, there is such a thing as a jubilee. It's a naturally occurring event. It happens, to the best of my knowledge, only in Mobile Bay, where, for reasons that are not entirely explicable to scientists, there are lots of theories about this, which we can talk about if you want, but where, for some reason, sea life, crabs and flounders and shrimp, suddenly rush up from the bottom of the bay and begin to beach themselves. And you can just go out with a net and a bucket and start scooping up all this delicious sea life for lovely feasts. And it's quite an exciting and beautiful scene to witness it. People standing on their porches overlooking the bay, shouting jubilee from house to house to let everybody know that it's happening. There's no way to predict when it's going to happen. And so it's this very exciting, beautiful thing that is specific to the place. It's one of the only things, that only ever happens in Mobile Bay. So there's that. The sort of other little literal element is this couple, they're sort of taking stock of their marriage on the eve of the husband's 50th birthday party. Mm-hmm. So that's the other sort of jubilee that they're approaching. And, you know, given the sort of longing that I was talking about that's at the heart of the story, there seemed to me, that's jubilee is such a celebratory word, right? But there was a kind of irony in titling a story about longing, titling it jubilee. So hopefully it has some resonance in that sense.
And great tension. I mean, I think that's really what these short stories do, is they're filled with just such wonderful tension. And the title being in tension with the underlying subject matter, I think, is just great. It's just great. So the first story is Water and Oil. And I also wanted to just point out the tie-in to the last story in the collection. But the narrator in this is so – the narrative choice and the point of view – for this story, standing alone is so interesting. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that story, your point of entry for it, but really specifically the point of view choice and the narrator choice.
So just so the reader, the listener knows, Water and Oil is about a kid who volunteers to patrol Mobile Bay looking for oil during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, which was, a thing that happened and was terrible and et cetera. So, the narrator in that story is an older man who lives on a houseboat at the marina that the kid's father owned. The kid's father owns, and where the kid works as a summer job. Like a lot of things, it was a little bit of trial and error. I started off writing that story in a sort of straight third person account story about the boy, and I found that. It was okay, but it lacked a little depth. It lacked a little richness, and it was just a sort of standard coming-of-age story.
Yep.
And so I started messing around with first person, I'd read, like, all my life. You've read them too, I'm sure. There are these narrators, especially in like 19th century fiction. They're third person narrators, but they sound like a first person narrator. They address the reader directly, and they will say things like. As many of us know, the countryside of England is blah, blah, blah. So they're including you in the telling of the story in some way.
House of Cards, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so I've always been sort of intrigued by what would happen in a story if a narrator revealed himself or herself rather than just sort of standing at the back of the room and telling the story with a kind of personality. And I think what happens here, what I hope happens in this story, is because this narrator is much older than the boy, and because this narrator has real affection for the boy and has a more worldly experience, especially when it comes to romance, and because it's hard for this narrator to watch this boy getting his heart broken without being able to interfere, that it adds a kind of depth and another layer to the experience of heartbreak and the experience of, that kind of loss of innocence that the story might not otherwise have, if it was just from the boy's point of view.
Yes. So great. It's so great. I wanted to ask if you have a sense, because it sounds like some of these stories evolved over time, or they, kind of were torn down and built up again. Do you ever discard a short story, or when do you know, okay, this project just isn't going to work out and I just got to toss it? Or, do you just stick with it and realize there's some kernel in here somewhere that I got to get out?
I don't think you ever, at least if we have any sense, we don't ever throw anything away. It happens too often, I think, that, you just fail to get a story right and fail to get a story right, and then you stick it in a file somewhere, or used to be stick it in a drawer somewhere, and come back to it 10 years later and see it with fresh eyes, and you understand it differently and you can approach it in a way that makes it work. There's a, this is really hard to articulate, and forgive me for being so inarticulate, but there is a place in a story, in the writing of a story, where for reasons that I can't quite explain, you suddenly begin on some unconscious level to understand, to know what the story is about, right? And so it becomes easier then to sort of pile up images and pile up sentences in a way that you kind of know that they're right. You just sort of sense it on a gut level that you're moving in the right direction. And that's when I know a story is going well, and when I know a story is worth sticking with. Now that is often preceded by months of beating my head against a brick wall and not being able to figure out what's working in the story or why the story should be important to me. And in a lot of those cases, I mean, you can only beat your head against that brick wall so long. You know, it's better for you as a writer and as a human being to put it aside for a while and come back to it later. Even if you don't ever go back and make the story work, you know, there's always an image that you can steal from that story or a sentence that you can steal from that story. I read an interview once with Michael Chabon, who was talking about a failed novel early in his career, and he described it as a kind of glorious shipwreck that he could dive down to once in a while and pull up some buried treasure from and put it in a different book. So I feel like that's always the case. There's nothing. We should never throw anything away.
That's great. I really, speaking of images, I mean, there's so many ways. I've never been to Alabama, I have to admit to you, and it feels so rich with metaphor and simile and great ways to describe human emotions that Southern California just doesn't have because we feel way more superficial than Alabama. But what a gift.
That can't be right.
I know it can't, but that's how it felt when I was reading this. I was like, oh man, well, if I had, the bayou, imagine what I could do.
okay. But all right. I feel kind of the opposite way. Like if I had LA or if I had, the redwood forest or if I had the desert, think of what I could do if I wasn't stuck with this lousy old South Alabama.
Yeah. But that is the beauty. I mean, I think wherever you are, you find such, obviously writers have to find such beautiful imagery, but man, you really found it. I mean, there were so many ways that the environment and the setting worked so well to inform these characters. And I guess that's what good writers do. But because I have never been to Alabama, it just felt so fresh and so interesting. And so, the perspectives felt so alive to me in new ways that I just hadn't, I don't encounter every day. So I really, I really enjoyed that.
Well, it makes me very happy to hear you say that. And I will say, I mean, it was important to me in this book. I've always written about South Alabama. I mean, I've written about other places also, but in some form or another, I've always written about the place where I grew up, but this is the first book that I have written which is entirely focused on that place, and it was important to me to try to make it come to life, to try to make it rich for readers who didn't know the place, and I hope that's happening.
Totally worked. Can you believe we're out of time? I don't know how this happens, but I wondered if you could leave us with short story advice that has sustained you, something that over the course of all the books that you've written, even the novels that you've written, something that, has come back to you as helpful advice over the years.
Do you mean something practical, like cut all your adverbs, or something a little more, I don't know, spiritual or philosophical or something like that?
Well, if you have the philosophical, I'll take that. Well, practical is always helpful, but I love the philosophical and spiritual, and we could all use a little more of that in our lives right now.
Gosh, here's the thing that's coming into my head. I don't know if this is a good answer to the question or not, but the thing that is coming into my head, it seems so simple, but the advice that I would give is be patient. And it's the thing that I find myself most often telling students, and the thing that I find myself having to remind myself of when I'm stuck is be patient. Keep working on that paragraph, keep working on that scene, dig a little deeper into those characters. Don't be in a hurry to, don't even be thinking about how am I going to make this a great story. Focus on how am I going to make this a good image or a good sentence? How am I going to make this line of dialogue as good as it can be? And then the rest of it, hopefully will all sort of come together. But, that thing, the hardest thing for me to learn as a writer, both in terms of like like a career path and in terms of like making a good story, was be patient. You know, don't try to rush it. Let the story come, and you'll get there eventually.
Yes, 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 yes. Such good advice. Michael Knight, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The pleasure was entirely mine. Thank you all so much for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.